Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nicholas Meyer, whose latest book is The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. Nicholas Meyer is the author of six novels, including 7% Solution, West End Horror, The Canary Trainer, Target Practice, Confessions of a Homing Pigeon, and co-author of Black Orchid, director of several movies, including Time After Time, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, The Day After, Volunteers, The Deceivers, writer of several screenplays, which I want to go into because apparently there is only a tenuous relationship at best between the screenplay credits and who actually wrote the screenplay. You've got at least four or five projects that are currently in various stages of development, according to IMDb.
Various stages of limbo, yes.
Before we actually tackle your memoir, let's talk about some of the upcoming projects. Don Quixote, where does that stand now?
One thing about a screenplay based on Don Quixote is it's not likely to date anytime soon. So at various times, I've had various actors wanting to make the movie. It's interesting that Hollywood has never made a Don Quixote movie. They've made musicals about the life of Cervantes, the Man of La Mancha, but they've never actually tackled the movie. So some years ago, and when I say some years ago, I'm not kidding, I got Paramount to finance the script, and they were going to make the movie, and then they had a bad summer and, you know, sort of riskier projects such as Two Guys on the Road in Baggy Pants didn't look so good. I'm still hoping to get it made, and as I say in my book, if you live long enough, you get to see your movies made, but you have to be long-lived.
What about Orpheus?
Orpheus was a pilot that I wrote about a young man who wakes up somewhere in the Pacific Northwest after a rock concert all alone, finds out that his possessions have all been swiped in the night, and he wanders into the nearest town where he sees working behind the counter at a truck stop the most beautiful woman he has ever seen in his life. And he's a sort of well-brought-up young man from New York City who's about to go into Yale in the fall. And instead, he hooks up with this amazing woman who says, "Wow, you look like you've been through the mill," you know, and offers him a shower and so forth. Only she turns out to belong to some mysterious cult. And the story of Orpheus, sort of paralleling the myth, is the story of his pursuit of her and his slow abandonment of everything that he knows and everything that he trusts to follow this woman into the world that she inhabits. Orpheus was shot as a pilot, not picked up.
Was this going to be for one of the cable networks then?
No, CBS.
CBS.
Maybe why it didn't get picked up.
Were you going to be the showrunner or no?
No. My exposure to television is very limited. I wrote some television movies back in the 70s, and I have the distinction of having directed the most watched television movie ever made, which was a nuclear war movie called The Day After in 1983. That record will not be broken anytime soon, 100 million people, because there's too many channels now. So I retired undefeated.
Nicholas Meyer, let's talk a little bit about your career and about this particular book. I noticed that you focused very heavily on Star Trek and gave some lip service to some of the other work you did, a lot of which I found extremely fascinating. You did talk extensively about The Day After, which is good. What's interesting is at one point you say, and then I wrote two novels, and go on. And those two novels, I believe, were Confessions of a Homing Pigeon and The Canary Trainer, which was the third Sherlock Holmes pastiche. Why did you decide to so quickly glide over them?
When I wrote my Sherlock Holmes novel, The 7% Solution, in which Holmes meets and matches wits with Sigmund Freud, it was the first novel that I was going to have published. When you are a first-time writer or even perhaps a fourth-time novelist, you have your intuition and your gut versus the expertise of the editor. When I wrote my Holmes novel, my editor said, Here's your manuscript back, here's the editing job I've done, and here's the thesis that informs the editing. Namely, that because your book is supposed to have been written in Victorian times, which it wasn't, but let that pass, but it's actually being addressed to late 20th century readership, so we're making some stylistic concessions to that readership. And I said, okay, I understand that theory. And I understood it right up until I read the manuscript. And I said, no, you have to put it all back, because I had a model, and the model was Doyle. And what he had done no longer read like Arthur Conan Doyle. And so I insisted that it go back to what it was. In this memoir, there was a lot more in this memoir. And it was me versus the expertise of my editor. This book was written last year during the Writers Guild strike, which is when I write my books, when you're not allowed to write screenplays. And you still have to send your kids to school and so forth and so on. So I knew that the way to get the book published was to hang it on the Star Trek movies. Having said that, I put in a lot of other stuff, and my editor kept saying, we've got to sort of go by this stuff a little faster. We've got to get to Star Trek. That's why people are going to want to buy the book. So not having the Holmes model to fall back on, I said, oh, okay, and allowed myself to be persuaded that I was perhaps duller than I am.
In other words, your editor said, if you want to get published, you better focus on Star Trek.
I mean, I did argue with him, and I kept in a lot of other stuff.
It struck me in reading this that while there is material that does not appear in your commentaries for the two Star Trek movies, a lot of it does appear there.
For starters, I've never listened to any of those commentaries.
Okay.
The idea of watching a movie while somebody is yakking in my
ear, I can't do it.
I could never do it. And basically, I've always created stuff for people who read. That's bedrock of whatever it is I do. Having said that, I think there is a lot of material there that's not in any of those commentaries. And there's also a lot of material on the writing of the 7% Solution and the other, and why I did the second Holmes book.
That's the stuff that really grabbed me. You are willing to take the blame for some bad behavior regarding Gene Roddenberry.
I have behaved badly.
But Nicholas Meyer, on the other hand, you've given us quite a few good films and at least one very good book, perhaps more than one very good novel.
Thank you.
Nicholas Meyer, you were born in New York, you came out to Hollywood, and you stumble into some very nice people who helped you along the way without apparently asking for anything in return. We hear a lot of horror stories about Hollywood, but I was once told that the main thing in Hollywood, since it's so hard to get anything actually done, is you have to sell yourself.
You know, there's a great line when Joy Page asks Bogey in Casablanca, what's Captain Reno like? And he says, oh, he's just the same as every other man, only more so. That's sort of Hollywood. Hollywood is people, it's the same, maybe a higher profile, or they throw big shadows, as somebody else said. Some of them are monsters, but most of them, I find, are not. And I don't think that I would have accomplished whatever it is that I have accomplished over these years without the help, the generosity, and in my case, I think particularly the patience that a lot of people have shown me while I was, you know, rolling around and foaming on their carpet or doing whatever it was I was doing. You know, there's a proverb in Hollywood that you can't make an omelet without stealing eggs. It may be true that when you see a really terrific movie, a lot of times there was blood on the floor to get there. I don't know, you know, what the Sistine Chapel was like, but I suspect there was probably other things spattering on that floor, too.
The spattering of blood is pretty delineated for the two Star Trek movies, including you're almost getting fired, which you don't find out about till long after it happened. But the spattering of blood and the crying out for more money, seems to be a constant theme in every single memoir I've read by directors trying to get their films made. It must be an extremely frustrating experience to go through years working on a project, get within 10 days or 5 days of the project, and then have it canceled on you.
There's all kinds of downsides to the phenomenon of making movies. I mean, let's assume that you do get the movie made that you wanted to get made, and let's assume that it comes out reasonably well, and then it dies at the box office, and you've said, wow, I've 5 or 10 years of my life have gone into this weekend, and even though there was blood, and even though there were divorces or mortgaged houses or whatever, and at the end of it, I finally, you know, made the movie that I wanted to make or something that's a reasonable approximation, and it dies. Think of it this way. I mean, right now the movie studios, such as they are basically run by marketing people as opposed to creative people. We have the tail now wagging the dog. They think of it as product. That's how they refer to it. It's product. So substitute the word toothpaste for movies. And now imagine that you are going to launch a new toothpaste. And it's taken years of research, and we've tasted a lot of different flavors, and a lot of people have worked on this toothpaste. But it's only going to have, you know, one day or one weekend, thanks to Twitter or whatever, to make its mark or have the TomTom factor, the word of mouth, spread on what this is. So wouldn't you feel better if it was called Crest 2? Wouldn't you feel better if it was, you know, Colgate Super New or Extra Formula? Anything with a precedent, anything to hang it on. So once marketing gets into the picture, you are becoming much more conservative in your choices. The movies become much more boring. And as for the amount of money, this is also because I don't think the world's best business people go into making movies. I think if you're a really good businessman, you know better than to try this. You sell weapons or something. But in fact, if you are in this business, then you tend to be not very adventurous. You want market research and demographics to tell you. And then you keep sort of lowering the bar and lowering the bar. And one of the things is that you tell yourself is you have to spend X hundreds of million dollars to make a movie, and if the movie only costs $30 million, you don't trust it anymore. So this is people stuffing money at budgets when Slumdog Millionaire or The Hangover, for much less, or Julie Julia, goes out and makes money. So there's never sort of the right amount of money, too much, too little, too late.
And you're trying to get what you can to make the films.
I also have a theory that art thrives on restrictions. And that when you can't get the money, that's when you have to start getting clever. And my favorite example of this is one of my favorite all-time movies, is the Laurence Olivier Henry V movie, where literally those medieval horses were, you know, wearing tie-dyed bedsheets or whatever it was, and you can't tell, and it's just great. It's just great.
Nicholas Meyer, Star Trek II, the big question everybody asks are whether those are Ricardo Montalban's pecs. And, of course, they are. Here's a question for you, though. When you were filming it, was that even in anybody's mind?
Anybody who saw the guy get dressed knew whose pecs they were. I think it was more like, wow, that is one great-looking guy. We heard that a lot.
It's kind of strange in reading the book, The View from the Bridge, Nicholas Meyer, kind of strange what people latch onto and what they let go of.
When I try to decide what book to write and what movie to make, I'm interested in the book that I would like to read or the movie that I would like to see. I would never tell you a joke that I didn't think was funny, on the off chance that you might find it amusing. The director, Robert Bresson, said, my job is not to find out what the public want and give it to them. My job is to make the public want what I want. And that's the challenge.
Star Trek recently got, quote, rebooted, and there are comparisons to the way you rebooted Star Trek II. And instead of looking at it as Wagon Train in Space, you looked at it as Captain Horatio Hornblower. J.J. Abrams, how did you think? Did you see the film?
Yes, I did.
And?
Well, I thought the movie was very clever. I should, you know, confess here that I've known J.J. Abrams since I attended his bar mitzvah, and he likes to remind me of that because apparently for his bar mitzvah I gave him the annotated Sherlock Holmes, the first annotated, which he said his son was now reading. I thought it was very clever in terms of laying out a sort of future basis for the franchise. And I thought the first 5 minutes were extremely exciting and rather moving, the birth of Kirk and so forth. I had little difficulty after that sort of understanding what the movie was about. Aside from the sort of assignment of rebooting the franchise, what is it about? That was more perplexing to me. I know what Star Trek VI is about. You know, it's about the collapse of the Soviet Union and a coup.
Right.
I know what Star Trek IV is about. It's an ecological fable, if you like. I didn't understand, I think, too well the themes, if there were themes.
I know a lot of people were very upset that an entire planet of Vulcans was wiped out and nobody seemed to care after 5 minutes.
This is not only a complaint that I have about that film, but it's a complaint I have about a lot of films that I see, is I get the feeling that the filmmakers don't take the story that they're telling seriously, that they're not really paying attention to the sort of emotional component of the narrative. And I think for that reason, a whole bunch of movies are sort of forgettable. And when you do have a movie where you become involved with the people, and I just saw a movie that I was sort of fascinated by called District 9, where it was sort of an E.T. element, and I thought, okay, you got me. I care about what's happening to these people. And a lot of times in movies, I feel not only do I not care, but that the people making the movie didn't care either.
An interesting thing about District 9 is that the aliens are never really explained. We don't know why they're there. We don't know any of their motivations. They're alien. And that reminds me of something that you say in your book, The View from the Bridge, which is that you don't have to tell the viewer everything. They can fill in their own gaps.
It's much better to leave things to people's imagination. I think what happens, if you think about this, is all great artistic media rely for their success on something that they omit. Paintings do not move. Music without words has no intellectual content whatever. It's just sounds. Printed words in a book, it's really code is what you're reading. And in every instance, it is the imaginative contribution of the viewer, the listener, the reader, that completes the work of art, that makes it come to life. The painting moves when it meets your eye. Movies alone have the hideous capacity to do everything for you. And I think directors, the best directors, have to sort of take that into consideration and decide what they can leave out. Because the more you can omit, the more the imaginative participation of the audience goes to work. And if you do it all for them, I think they tend to go to sleep. At least I do, and I can only speak for myself. So every time somebody points to something in a movie, do you have to cut to what they're pointing to you? Do you have to reveal it? Do you have to show them? Does every question that anybody asks in a movie have to be answered? Or is it more interesting if it's not? And I think when things are answered, when big questions are answered or enough little ones are answered, the gas goes out of the whole thing. It's like explaining a magic trick. You may be dying to know, but once you do know, it's always anticlimactic.
Then what does someone like J.J. Abrams do, let's say, with the end of Lost, when everybody's waiting to see, well, what is the solution? Because if he doesn't give it, you're frustrated, and if he does give it, you're disappointed.
There's a kind of movie that I call a This Better Be Good movie. And a This Better Be Good movie is a movie where you are actually posing some questions and you on the audience thinking, God damn, if there isn't a good answer for all of this, you know, I want my money back. And that's certainly legitimate. You want a payoff. If the guns of Navarone don't blow up, or as Ibsen said, if you put a rifle over the mantle in Act 1, that rifle better go off by the end of Act 3. And this poses some very interesting dramatic questions for movie makers. For example, when they made The Bridge on the River Kwai from the novel by Pierre Boulle, in the novel, they don't blow up the bridge. Doesn't happen. But in a movie, going back to that, you know, rifle over the mantle, it's got to blow up. But somehow you have to preserve Pierre Boulle's theme, which is that war is absurd and crazy. And what the brilliance of the Bridge on the River Kwai is, they had their cake and he ate it too. They fulfilled the promise of the movie. The bridge had to go, but you also had to make Pierre Boulle's point, which, and the last line of the movie is madness, madness, and the audience gets it, no problem. So it is a bit of a tightrope act. There are movies where you say, well, this better be good. And, you know, by the time you get to the end of The Manchurian Candidate, by God, it is good. It's very good.
That brings up, of course, the ending of Star Trek II, which is something that you railed about when you were making the movie, which is that if Spock isn't really dead, what's the emotional impact of the end of the film?
The movie was made. Spock was going to die. That was the movie. Then by the time we were finished making the movie and everybody was loving the movie and suddenly the franchise, you know, theoretically had this shot in the arm and people were saying, you know, this movie's going to be a hit. Why not there be more Star Treks? How can there be more Star Treks without Spock? Maybe we better give this some thought. And I, who by this time, I don't know that I was a Star Trek maven or aficionado, but I certainly understood from all the letters the involvement, the level of emotional involvement of so many of the people who had watched this television show and were deeply fond of Spock. And as I said to the management, it's all right if you kill him, but you have to kill him well. Now, if you're telling me that having put everybody through this emotionally wrenching ordeal, we're only going to say, just kidding, I thought, that's sort of unforgivable. So I fought, and now looking back, I'm not sure that what they wound up with wasn't okay, which is, he does die, but there is a sort of a hint, an implication that maybe other things may be in store. So they managed to sort of have their cake and eat it too.
Your first movie was Time After Time, and a lot of people I know love that film. How do you feel about it now?
I have said that movies are like souffles. They either rise or they don't. I had an editor, my editor on The Wrath of Khan, also edited The Day After, had a production company, or said he wanted to have a production company, called Miracle Pictures. And their sobriquet was, if it's a good picture, it's a miracle. Time After Time has a certain miraculous quality to it because I had never directed a movie before. I'd written a number of them. I'd directed plays on stage and done a lot of radio plays, as it happened. But I'd never directed a movie. When I look at the movie, I see all the mistakes that I made. Sometimes that's all I can see is the things that I did wrong. My lack of experience in staging or cinematography, those things to which I came late in my career, as opposed to the writing and editing, which is really just a kind of writing, so I was good at that. But I also can't argue with the fact that notwithstanding the mistakes or the clumsiness of some of the execution, that's a souffle that rose and has stayed happily aloft, and people love that movie. And I ain't going to argue with you.
The movie The Day After, which you go into some detail on how it came to be and the response to it, which was that it may have actually had a response on the world stage, seems to have had some kind of response if Reagan saw it.
After The Day After, reporters ran around, shoved microphones in front of everybody's face and said, did this movie change your mind about nuclear war, one way or the other? And then came back to me with their microphones and said, well, everybody says the movie didn't change their mind. What do you have to say about that? And I had a lot to say about it. The first thing I said is, I don't think people change their minds about things overnight, A. B, I don't think a lot of people are going to allow as how their minds are changed about so large and urgent a topic as nuclear war by a TV movie, B. And C, half the time I think that none of us are quite sure what it is that we believe anyway. We think we know. We say what we think we know, or we say what we'd like other people to think we believe. But I think it isn't until you're on your deathbed or somebody's got a gun to your head that you're going to find out what you really believe. One of the things that was discovered is that as the months went by, a lot of people were powerfully affected by this film, and the nuclear freeze movement, you know, got a big shot in the arm. But one of the people whose mind was changed, and changed almost instantaneously by seeing the day after, was Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan came to his first term with the concept of the possibility of a winnable nuclear war. 20 million dead, an acceptable number. Somebody who said, if we have enough shovels, you know, we'll win. In his memoir, and also in the biography of him called Dutch, written by Edmund Morris, who says the only time he ever saw Ronald Reagan depressed was after seeing this movie. There's a lot of detail as to, you know, the sort of stages that he went through. But it is also true that following this movie, he went to Reykjavik and negotiated the Intermediate Range Weapons Treaty with Mikhail Gorbachev. And somebody said to him, you still think the Soviet Union is the empire of evil? And he said, no. And he basically says in his memoir that it was this movie that helped to change his mind. So that makes it just about the most useful thing I've gotten to do so far today.
And how do you feel now you look back on it? And, you know, because it sounded like that was just a job you picked up at the time and you were into it, but the idea that it would have some kind of lasting effect, I guess you can't think about those things.
Artists lose all proprietary authority over their creations when they're finished. They're out in the world, and whether it's a book or a movie, other people are going to make of it what they will. I didn't fall into the day after casually. That I don't think is an accurate description. I didn't want to direct the day after. I was the fourth director asked. I think, like most people, I don't like to think about nuclear war. We all semi-consciously or unconsciously aware of all these weapons that are sitting there in their various shelters and stockpiles and missile heads, but we don't like to think about it. We just sort of go about our business and mainly hope that nothing bad will happen. But here was Hollywood giving me a chance to put my work in the service of my beliefs, something you don't get often, and I realized that I just didn't want to sit around at, you know, dinner parties and bitch about the state of the world if I had a chance to do something. That left me very reluctantly, but not casually, by default, the director of this movie. It's not an easy movie to watch. The most peculiar thing about the making of the movie was a realization that I had early on that the movie shouldn't be too good because people would rather discuss anything than the topic of nuclear war. It would be easier for them to talk about how good Jason Robards was, or how wonderful Joe Beth Williams was, or how about that gorgeous cinematography, or boy, that was a well-edited film. Anything, 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 rather than talk about the subject. So the movie had to be crafted in a kind of counterintuitive exercise, so that there were no distinguishing characteristics.
Could that be a flaw of Schindler's List, then?
That it was too well done?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I would want to see the movie again. I think it really depends. The acid test is, what do you find yourself talking about when you leave the theater? Do you find yourself talking about Ralph Fiennes as Amos Goth, or do you find yourself talking about, you know, what a great piece of directing it is, or are you shattered by the film? And I think most people were pretty shattered by Schindler's List.
Right. In terms of a movie like The Day After, you know, people don't want to see that movie, yet people flock to see these disaster movies where the world gets destroyed. Is there a dichotomy there?
Yes. I think that the kind of movies where the world gets destroyed, like in The Day After Tomorrow, the New York Times, I think, called it, they said, this kind of looks fun. The way this was a special effects feast, and the thing that CGI and effects now enable us as filmmakers to do is anything. Anything you can visualize, imagine, we can do it for you. And it's sort of fun to see. But that's different. And I think I say in my memoir, thank God we didn't have those kinds of CGI effects in the movie. Or, again, people would have been sort of beguiled by the effects. And we didn't want that. We just wanted you to say, if you have a nuclear war, it's going to be pretty bad.
Nicholas Meyer, editing is a very important part of filmmaking, a huge part. And I think people don't quite understand the value and the importance of a good editor. But an editor could make or break your work completely, right?
Well, theoretically, only with your connivance, because the editor is an extension of, or should be an extension of, your will, your impulses. But since filmmaking is a collaborative effort, he should also be bringing his own expertise and inspiration to the task at hand. Somebody said that dailies are sentences in a book that hasn't been written yet, and editing is the ordering or shortening or juxtaposing of those sentences, those snippets of films, the close-ups, the wide angles, the tracking shot, whatever. And there is an art to how those are put together, and depending on how those are put together, performances can be made and lost. The pace of the film can likewise click along like an express train, or just really sag. Audiences today, with ever shorter attention spans because we're bombarded with so much stimuli from your headphones, from your cell phones, from your iPhones, from your video games, the this, the that. So editing tends to go faster and faster. If you are telling a compelling story and the audience is really involved, they will sit still for the pace that you set. If they're not involved, then it seems slow and boring and draggy. But if they care about what's going on, they'll be with you. Henry James said that the least demand you can make of a work of art is that it be interesting, and the most demand is that it be moving. So if you fall somewhere between those two, you're in business.
A couple of quick questions here. One of them came from actually a Barnes & Noble review of your book. Mentioned that there's some obvious product placement in the film Volunteers, where someone drinks a Coke. Was that real product placement, or was that just something that happened in the film?
No, it was not product placement. I always was very troubled by the... I mean, there they are in Thailand and remote from everything, and the girl is walking out of our hero's life, and the whole thing about him is that he is, pardon the expression, a procurer, a guy who can get his hands on anything, and he knows what she misses most about America and home and the world they've left behind, and he says, how about a Coke? Maybe it's understandable, but it's also sort of cynical to assume that just because somebody offers somebody a Coke in a movie, there's a tie-in. There wasn't.
You were involved in the screenplay of what became Fatal Attraction. You said at one point that you had problems with the film's ending. Were you involved with the original ending of the film?
When I was shown the screenplay to read, which I believe was originally called Deception, in that original screenplay, Michael Douglas is arrested by the police at the end of the movie and taken away for the murder of Alex Forrest and his wife and family sort of disappearing through the rear window of the car. And that's the end of the movie. That's what I was shown. And I said, wow, that's pretty heavy. He didn't really kill her. It seems to me that the kind of movie we're making, or that you're making, I was talking to Stanley Jaffe, was this is one of those movies where the audience wipes their hand over their forehead and goes, phew, that was close. In Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train, at the ending of the movie, the carousel's gone round and round and round, and Bruno is dying at the end, and Guy Haines leans over to him and says, Bruno, you're dying. For heaven's sake, tell the truth. And Bruno says, well, I'd like to help you out, Guy, but you know that you did it. At which point he dies, and his hand opens up, and there's the lighter that he was planning to plant at the scene of the crime, and the cops now know. And everybody goes, phew, that was close. And I said, that's the kind of ending that we want. So the ending that I wrote for Fatal Attraction, which was also filmed, was that he's being driven away, and as he's being driven away, he turns to his wife, Ann Archer, and he says, call my lawyer. His number's in my address book. It's upstairs in my office. So there's a very long shot of him being driven away, and Ann Archer, poor Ann Archer, is totally shell-shocked with boiled bunnies and God knows what else, and she, in a trance, goes back up to that attic office of his and pulls out the desk drawer looking for the address book, and there's that cassette that we've seen earlier, the one that said, play me. And we never heard the whole tape because she came up and surprised him while he was listening to it with the headphones on. So she's looking, she's rummaging for the address book, and the audience is yelling, play the tape, play the tape. And finally she sees the tape, and she puts it in, and she hears essentially the rest of the threat, which is, if you don't do right by me, I'll kill myself, and they'll think you did it. I'll make them think that. And then there's a kind of a superimposed image of Glenn Close as Cho-Cho San from Madame Butterfly, the opera, which she likes so much, committing Harry Carey in the bathrobe wearing a kimono. And that's the ending that got the movie made. Later on, as I was setting off for India to do The Deceivers with Pierce Brosnan and Merchant Ivory, I get a call from Paramount saying, we need another ending. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, here's the thing. And this is a very interesting example of what happens when the screenplay gets filmed. When I made the screenplay, I thought the audience should be of two minds about Alex Forrest. She's either a vicious bitch or she is a very neurotic, confused, disturbed woman. The Hedda Gabler syndrome. You could look at her both ways. But in fact, when Glenn Close played it, the audience only looked at it one way. They wanted her blown away. And I couldn't do it because I was flying overseas, and so the original author, James Dearden, and the screenplay is mainly his, went back, and they did the ending from Diabolique, where she rises out of the bathtub and Ann Archer blows her away. And that's the story.
Nicholas Meyer, you mentioned a number of movies that you did work on the screenplay for that were made with other directors, including The Human Stain, Elegy. There must have been a lot of movies you worked on here or there, little pieces that you got no credit for that no one knows you worked on, but you did.
That's true.
And you can't talk about them?
Well, I could talk about them if I can think of them, but the problem is my mind doesn't quite work like that. I've worked on some James Bond. I'd worked on a couple of James Bond movies. You help each other. If your friend is producing a movie and they're having trouble with something and you say, do you think you could write this scene? And the movie business, like music, is a kind of a patchwork business. And at the end, somebody gets an Oscar and you go, yeah, that's interesting.
And you've seen little pieces of your work in various films that you don't get the credit for.
Yes, occasionally I have. Occasionally I have.
And Nicholas Meyer, let's get a little bit further along to your recent work, Vendetta, you made for HBO.
Correct.
Did you find that dealing with HBO was that much easier than dealing with anyone else, or was it more or less the same?
Well, I had no problems dealing with HBO making Vendetta, which we should explain is not the feature film where the man wears that mask.
It's not V for Vendetta, yeah.
Yeah, it's not V for Vendetta. Vendetta is the true story of the largest lynching in American history, not African Americans, as one might anticipate, but rather Sicilians in New Orleans in 1890, who were accused of gunning down the very popular and very corrupt New Orleans chief of police, David Hennessy, on his way home from work in a heavy fog in October. His alleged last words when a cop over, you know, said, did you see who did it? And he said, Dagos. And that was all the excuse that Mayor Joe Shakespeare, real name, needed to round up 400 Sicilian immigrants and indict 19 of them, put 11 of them on trial. They were acquitted. and the judge refused to let them out of jail, held them overnight on a technicality, long enough for an advertisement to appear the following morning on the New Orleans Picayune that said, "Mass meeting, men wanted, come prepared for action to redress the defects of justice in the Hennessy case." And 20,000 people showed up, stormed the jail, shot, stabbed, hanged, used for target practice while they were hanging these nine hapless men. And the rest of the country thought that they had done a very good thing. So it's a very strange story, and I had a very good time making the movie. The only problem was that when the movie was finished, John Matoyan, the head of HBO Films, who had made the film, lost a power struggle with the management, and somebody new came in, and the decision was made, in effect, to bury the film. So it didn't get a very wide show, although it's on DVD.
Your recent work, what's the story on the rise of Theodore Roosevelt?
The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, as I say, you live long enough and you see your movies get made, is based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Edmund Morris. It was originally written to be directed by Martin Scorsese, who is now the producer of it. And the director of it, the last time I looked, is Taylor Hackford. And we'll see what happens.
Your screenplay for The Odyssey, which people can find online on your website.
I wrote a two-part version of The Odyssey, which was originally for HBO, produced by Francis Coppola, and also supposed to be directed by me. I suffered a personal tragedy at this time. My wife died of breast cancer, and I had a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old to raise. So I couldn't direct the movie. So I pulled out. When I pulled out, HBO decided that they weren't going to do it, and they sold it to Robert Halmy, the famous masher of classics, who laid it off at NBC, where they threw out my screenplay and did The Odyssey. I like to say The Odyssey, according to Danielle Steele. It was pretty bad. And I was so annoyed that I put my screenplay online, and I believe it's still there because I liked it so much. I thought I did such a great job.
It is still there. And four projects, which may or may not exist, that are on IMDb, a George Washington project.
Yes, I wrote it. I wrote it.
Something called Eunice?
It's called Banker to the Poor. And Banker to the Poor is a movie, which is quite an interesting movie and probably will be made, about the life of Muhammad Yunus. And for those unfamiliar, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, not the economics prize, but the Peace Prize. He is a Bangladeshi banker who invented microcredit. Some Frenchman hired me to write a movie about his life based on his book, Banker to the Poor.
And The Crimson Petal in White, that's, I think, Michelle Faber?
Yes, it is, and that was written a long time ago, and I have no idea. Good script. I like it.
And Patient Number One?
Patient Number One is at HBO.
And that will exist?
The planets have to align.
Well, Nicholas Meyer, you've written all of this. Are you ever going to write another novel?
I would like to. Writing this memoir, The View from the Bridge, which I wrote again because the Writers Guild went on strike and I had to earn some money, I rediscovered the pleasures of prose. There was something very nice about, you know, not keeping track of a page count or, you know, other technical requirements. Because the difference between a novel and a screenplay is a screenplay has to adhere to a certain dramatic form. There are, if you read Aristotle's Poetics, certain, they may not be requirements, but they seem to be characteristics of what the dramatic form demands. It has to be, you know, digestible at a single sitting and so forth. But in fact, a novel can be anything. It can be in the second person, it can be in the third person, it can be in the first person, it can be 300 pages long, it can be 1,000 pages long. And that elasticity does appeal to me, if anyone's still reading novels.
You've been listening to an interview with Nicholas Meyer, whose memoir is titled The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.